On this episode of Skeptico.
When I was watching one of your presentations, you said, you know what? If I don't give you this protocol right now, if I don't give this to you at least a little bit, I would consider it medical malpractice. As a clinical psychologist, I know this is effective and you have to experience. Now, that's awesome on the one hand of getting it out there, but it also does bring into focus just how out of a line we are in medicine and in clinical psychology.
Let me quote you. This is a direct quote from a veteran who took part in one of our studies in Miami. And he said, every intervention I've had to date to help me heal through my post-traumatic stress has always started with what's wrong with me and trying to show me what's wrong with me and how to fix and change what's wrong with me. He said, you're the first protocol, you're the first intervention that has started with what's right about me. And now that I know what's right about me, I'm willing to face my worst nightmares.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. Now, you know from listening to this show that I love science and I love the logical, rational, reasonable approach to things, but you can probably also tell that I'm trying to marry that with an approach to spirituality, an engagement with spirituality, if you will. And along the way, along the journey of Skeptico at the same time, I've been pursuing spiritual practices as well, but I have had this pull towards yoga for a long, long time, and it's been an amazing experience for me because it's taken me in a lot of different places beyond the practice of sitting there and doing these asanas and breathing and doing all that stuff. So when I ran across the work of today's guest, Richard Miller, a lot of the ideas that he was talking about were not unfamiliar to me. But at the same time, I found somebody who was really putting some of these things together in a new and powerful way. And as I say in the interview, I was just drawn to him because I listened to one of his lectures and it immediately seemed to work for me. Now, as I say in the interview, I've included that at the end of this show. So give a listen to that. I've mixed it in with a little bit of meditative Creative Commons music, and I'm including that at the end. Also have it as a separate download if you want it, if you find it useful. So the exciting thing about Richard's work is it seems to work, at least for people like me. It's piling up a lot of points scientifically as well. And of course, as we've said so many times in this show, there is really no way that this technique should pile up points scientifically. There's no way in our therapeutic models that this should work if mind equals brain. Ah, but that's another show for another time. Let's get on to my conversation with Richard Miller. Today we welcome Dr. Richard Miller to Skeptico. Richard is a clinical psychologist and founder of iREST, an organization that offers an integrated yogic healing practice that Richard has developed over the years. And this practice has been shown to be so effective in clinical trials that the United States military has adopted it for use in treating post-traumatic stress disorder in hundreds of military hospitals and clinics around the country. Now, how Richard got the Army to let yoga in the back door is just one of the many stories I hope we get into today. Before we get too much further, Richard, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning, Alex. Thanks for having me on your program.
Delighted. You know, we both share a deep love and appreciation for yoga. And even though I can't sit in full lotus anywhere nearly as beautifully as you do, when I was reading your bio, I was struck by this early experience you had with yoga. And I realized that we shared a very similar kind of first experience that I don't know how these things play themselves out. I'm sure we can kind of have some ideas about that, but maybe you could start by sharing that little story because I thought it was kind of interesting and speaks a lot to a lot of things that have happened in your life.
Sure. And just one beginning comment. Thank goodness it doesn't depend on our posture and lotus and anything we do to be who we are. We are just lovely beings, however and wherever we are. You know, my first experience with yoga was quite accidental and quite profoundly transformative. The story I shared with you when I first came to San Francisco, I was looking to meet people and wandered into taking a yoga class with the thought that I might be able to meet some interesting people, having never studied yoga before. And as I walked into the first class, it turns out that they decided to teach the 12-week course in silence, except for the teacher's instruction. So I wandered in the door and walked out each of the 12 weeks, never met anyone because everything was in silence from the moment I entered and left the building. But I like to say that first class at the end, when the teacher was introducing us to a meditative form of what I now know as yoga nidra, I had a profound experience where all sense of myself as separate dropped away unexpectedly, and I found myself with a deep inner feeling of being in harmony and in tune with the entire universe. And when I walked out and came home that night, a deep kind of vow rose in my heart to try to understand, one, what just happened, and two, how might I nourish and propagate this profound understanding, which lasted for some days and then slowly faded. But what it did bring for me is a sense of coming home to myself in a way that I had never experienced before that moment, a deep, profound peace, and just a celebration of homecoming, I would say.
You know, that's awesome. And you are now speaking to a group of people that will resonate to that story. At least some of my audience will. But like me, some of them will also want to kind of jump over on this other side of bringing that down and want to struggle to pin that down to something more concrete, something we
Correct.
Can wrap our arms around. And one of the things that's interesting about you and your background is you embody that as well. You embody that scientific background. You're a clinical psychologist. And as you were led through this journey that you were on, you were forced to bring a great deal of rigor and science to what you do in order to work with, for example, the United States military. So you're someone, a skilled researcher, skilled clinical psychologist, published some amazing results about this yogic meditation protocol that you've developed, published it in peer-reviewed journals, passed muster with some very tough-minded military folks who aren't willy-nilly about just letting people come in and do stuff to their soldiers. Can you tell us a little bit about that side of who you are and what you've brought in that area?
Yes. I grew up in a scientific, medically oriented family. My dad was a surgeon, and we had long conversations about science and medicine as I grew up. And I grew up in a way reading medical textbooks, was on my way to go to medical school and realized that psychology was really my calling and ended up going into clinical psychology. But along the way, it occurred to me as I was studying the teachings of yoga and different approaches to spirituality that many of the readings were propagated on a more or less a belief of trust me. And as a scientifically oriented Westerner, trust me doesn't really resonate so much with me. I wanted to understand, how does this actually work? And so I started reading into the literature in the 70s and 80s. And then in 2004, the military called me and asked if I would be interested in partaking in a study of my protocol with veterans and active duty coming back from the war front with PTSD. So I said, fantastic. We entered into a study, and as a result, the results we got were so effective, they hired the teacher that I had trained who was teaching in the study to teach the protocol to all returning wounded warriors through Walter Reed Army Medical Center if they opted for that option as part of their healing program. Particular study launched what I would never have imagined, a whole series of studies. So to date, we've got over 25 research studies that have been done from Walter Reed, Miami VA, Brook Army Medical Center. Now we've got one about to start at Chicago VA. We've had them at universities and in different private settings. So we've been studying how does this protocol actually affect things like post-traumatic stress, chronic pain, anxiety, sleep disorders, as well as propagate a deep inner sense of well-being. So I'm glad to say I can now answer the question, don't just trust me, here are the results that we have that are statistically showing that this particular approach to meditation does work, and here's what it does and can do for you. And to date, I've trained over 3,000 teachers worldwide who are now bringing this into their different settings in North America, Australia, England, Australia, Germany. So it's quite amazing to see how I think the science has propagated and helped support the coming home of this protocol into so many locations. And
Richard, just let's interject that that is through this organization that you've founded that people can find called iREST. And that's where the training is kind of funneled through and where you've brought all this technology, if you will, to a focal point. Is that right?
It is true. And there's a funny story here. When I first came to the military, or they came to me, they said, would you change the name of your protocol, which was back then called Yoga Nidra? And they said, we don't do yoga. We're military, and yoga is for sissies, actually, one fellow said to me. And so I thought long and hard and changed the name to Integrative Restoration. Integrative because it integrates our psychology and it gives us a grounded sense of self. And restoration because it restores something to us that never is capable of being hurt or harmed, that's always whole. And then I thought of the acronym iREST, a small I, because it's helping kind of put our ego in its rightful place, and rest for restoration. The military said, that's fantastic. We can do integrative restoration, iREST. But then at the end of the study, after a few months, they came back to me and they said, you know, we like what you're doing. This is showing great results with our military or veterans. So you can call it Yoga Nidra if you want. So we've created the name Integrative Restoration iREST Yoga Nidra Meditation. That way we can go into military settings, homeless shelters. We're now working with women who've been rescued from human trafficking, and we can call it Integrative Restoration. That has a nice secular ring to it. But if I go into a yoga-oriented group, I can call it Yoga Nidra. Or if I go into a meditation-oriented group, I can call it meditation. So the long and the short is we're trying to bring it to different groups, showing that it's actually a secular program. Anybody can utilize it irregardless of their philosophical, religious, or spiritual stance. It's really basically a series of inquiries that we make, experiments that we make into who we are and how we function, and it's been shown now to help heal things like post-traumatic stress and anxiety and help people get a good night's sleep.
Now, Richard, I want folks to know that I watched one of your videos, a few months ago, where you gave a condensed version of this meditation protocol. And personally, I found it so powerful, so meaningful, useful, whatever word you want to put there, that I've incorporated it into my regular practice. I actually mixed it in with a little music. And with your permission, I'm going to play that at the end of this interview, because there's no substitute for talking about it than there is for hearing this and hearing just the little unique ways that you have adapted. You know, almost anyone out there is going to be familiar with some kind of meditation protocol, if you will, someone doing a guided meditation kind of thing. But you do a couple of unique things in there that I want people to experience for themselves and just see if it has any of these amazing effects that we're talking about. So with your permission, I will play that at the end of this interview.
Great. I like what you're saying. A picture is worth a thousand words. Actually experiencing it is what we want. We can talk till we're blue in the face, but the experience is the most important.
Okay, so then let's switch gears for a minute, because I hope by now you get the sense that I am with you, man. I am with you. I'm supportive of what you're doing. I want everyone to experience it, because I think if you're at the right place in your life, in your journey, in your practice, whatever, this could be meaningful to you. But now that I've said that, I want to kind of pick at a couple of things that I think interface with some of the topics we've talked about here on Skeptico, and I think are gnawing at the back of the mind of me and other people who look at this stuff.
But let's
go for it. Great. Let's start with this. Let's start with malpractice. I love this, that when I was watching one of your presentations, one of the things you started with, and I saw a certain animation to give certain energy to your talk, you said, you know what, if I don't give you this protocol right now, if I don't give this to you at least a little bit, I would consider it medical malpractice. As a clinical psychologist, I know this is effective and you have to experience. Now, that's awesome on the one hand of getting it out there, but it also does bring into focus just how out of a line we are in medicine and in clinical psychology with some of these kind of practices, techniques, protocols, whatever we want to talk about it. So can you address that from both angles of what you mean by malpractice? I think I got the first part right, but correct it. But the second part is, you know, you're not going to likely to run into this if you just walk into the local clinical psychologist.
No. Let me quote you. This is a direct quote from a veteran who took part in one of our studies in Miami. And he said, every intervention I've had to date to help me heal through my post-traumatic stress has always started with what's wrong with me and trying to show me what's wrong with me and how to fix and change what's wrong with me. He said, you're the first protocol, you're the first intervention that has started with what's right about me. And now that I know what's right about me, I'm willing to face my worst nightmares. But I realize now I'm not broken. There's not something wrong with me. There are things in my body and my mind that need changing and fixing and helping, but not me. So, and he also went on to say, why didn't I get this when I first started this journey of trying to heal my post-traumatic stress? And I've heard this now countless times from military soldiers, veterans, homeless, all the different people that we work with. What I'm trying to do right at the start is show people something about themselves, something about ourselves, all of us, that's not broken, can't be harmed, has never been hurt or harmed, has always been whole. So I'm trying to help people start from wholeness and then look at what does need fixing or changing. But we're not trying to fix or change to become whole. We're realizing we are whole. We start from here. And so we realize there's not something about me that's broken, but there are things about my body and my mind that need fixing and that do feel broken. It's a radical kind of reorientation when I work with people. And I'll tell you a clinical story. I was working with a woman who came to me with severe depression some years ago, and she had been through many forms of psychiatry and medical medicinal interventions. Nothing had worked with her depression. And I started by asking her, would you be willing to make an experiment and let me try something with you? And she said, okay. So I ran her through this very simple protocol where I'm introducing her to this, what I think of within ourselves, that's always whole and never been broken. And within about 20 minutes, she was sitting in a place within herself where she felt not broken, not something wrong with me. And then we started addressing her depression and what were the underlying symptoms that might have been causing, or what are the underlying causes that might have been giving her rise to her symptoms. The thing that was most interesting to me is she came back the second session and she said, I want to let you know that when I was working with you in that first session, I really did feel this sense of something within me that's not broken, isn't depressed, and never has been, even as I'm feeling this depression. And when I left your office, what it did is it gave me hope. It reinstalled a sense of hope in me that I can actually work and overcome my depression. And we worked together very successfully over about a year and a half. Her depression did clear up, but we always started each session from this place of wholeness, really letting her know that she wasn't broken, she wasn't depressed, but feelings of depression, sensations of depression were present in her body and her mind that then we began to seriously address. So it's a very different starting point. We don't work to heal into wholeness. We work from wholeness in whatever healing we need to do.
Fantastic. Let me kind of get at this a slightly different way. I want to get into kind of philosophy of science a little bit. Let's
sure.
talk a little bit about consciousness and materialism. I was reading an excellent interview you did with Vikram Zitsu of the Sutra Journal, in which you said, interestingly, the modern materialistic view is being thoroughly challenged by neuroscience and quantum research, which are revealing two distinct ways the brain perceives reality. And then you list those two ways, one from a dualistic time-space separate self-material perspective. What you're really saying is that's science, man. I mean, that is science as we know it. And
exactly.
then you said they're also viewing it from a non-local, no time-space, no self, this non-dual, spiritually enlightenment path, awakening path that we kind of hear about, but a lot of people don't even make that connection, I have to say, and a lot of people listening to this interview are not necessarily making the connection between what they're hearing about this quantum physics, quantum mind thing, and the non-dual thing. But I'm blabbering on here. I want to get to that secondly. First, yeah. I want to challenge that notion that neuroscience, that modern neuroscience is really ready to let go of materialism. Man, I don't see it at all. And I think sometimes we do a disservice to folks, like the folks who walk into the office of their local clinical psychologist after experiencing a spiritually transformative experience and are told, here are your meds, you're crazy, let's stop that voice inside your head. And they have one experience, and then they hear folks like you and other folks who say, wow, you know, modern medicine is changing and neuroscience is really opening up and things are looking different. No, they're really not. Neuroscience isn't letting go of materialism.
Let's take a slightly different view, which is they're not in opposition. And I'd like to actually take the word spiritual, and which means simply an inspiration, an in-breath, an ability to have an insight into something of ourselves that's greater than our limited sense of self. But let me put that off to the side. What neuroscience is showing is that there are two very distinct aspects to the way we see reality. One is our genetic coding through our five senses and our thinking mind and our eyes, our senses, which are programmed to create a sense of border, boundary, separate objects, so that when I look at you or I look at a tree, I see a separate object that has borders and boundaries and limitations. That is built into us genetically encoded. We cannot not see separate objects. But on the other standpoint, we see that neuroscience is showing that we can also step out of that into another, we might say, region of our brain, which doesn't know time, it doesn't know space, it doesn't have a sense of being localized or bordered or boundaried. It feels itself as this unbounded, infinite, outside of time, outside of brokenness. And what the protocol, like what I teach, does is it opens up both these, we'll call them channels, so that they're equally viable and operating at the same time. Most people have collapsed only into the one side, the more materialistic, time-bound, limited sense of self. And they haven't explored this other region, which we might say meditation and different approaches do. And what I found in that first experience, I would say, with yoga back in 1970, which I didn't understand then and now I do, was in that moment, I opened to this other non-materialistic side of my brain and nervous system and had a glimpse of what I would call stepping out of time, stepping out of space and limitation. Over the years, through my own practices and also my research into science, in a way, I've learned how to integrate these. So they're both now functioning in me. I can see separate objects, but yet I feel something else that transcends that sense of separation. I don't feel a sense of separation. And what that does for us is it opens a deep quality where we see, in a certain manner of speaking, everything as expressions of our deeper sense of self or nature. So when I look at a tree, I see tree, but I also have a sense that the tree isn't separate from me. What that does is it gives rise to great compassion, kindness, respect for everything that I see, because in a way it's an aspect of myself. So it breeds a deep sense of love and kindness, but it also respects border and boundary and my ability to differentiate and take actions that sometimes creates a sense of border and boundary and safety. So these practices are actually opening up a whole nother region of our brain that's also genetically encoded into us. Most of our materialistic approaches of psychology or medicine hasn't really investigated that other side. It's kind of dismissed it. Now it's opening. And I agree with your statement that neuroscience on one level is opening these doors. On another level, it's met with a lot of skepticism, which I think is good. Doubt and skepticism help us entertain, is this really true? And we keep the science moving forward so we can really investigate it. But at some point, I think those who are skeptical, if they're really open, are going to have to admit there's a whole nother domain here. And when they start to experience it, it will shift their understanding of reality in a much more comprehensive view, where we have both the dualistic framework, separation, separate objects, that's the domain of our five senses and mind, and this other domain, which doesn't know separation, sees everything as an aspect of ourself. And that opens a whole nother way of being in the world. And then bring these two together, and they fit very nicely in an integrative fashion, and that's why I call my protocol integrative restoration. It integrates these two perspectives in a beautiful way.
That's great. And since I generally agree with what you're saying, I don't think the boundaries are quite as distinct and firm as we say. I think it's always blurry for all of us, but I'm sure you'd agree with that. One thing I wanted to highlight that you said, because I love to rail against the materialistic nonsense, because I think it is so, we're so enmeshed in it in our culture that you can't say enough just how we need to wake up from that nonsense, provable nonsense. But I digress again, because one of the things you said that I really want to highlight is less opposition. You said, Alex, you know, maybe it's not a complete transformation, but we do see less opposition from neuroscience, from materialistic medicine. I think that's a great way of putting it, because I think that's undeniable. I think the whole movement towards, you know, the quantum mind, panpsychism kind of resting place that is in between materialism and a completely consciousness is fundamental kind of perspective is kind of evidence of that. And I think you highlight some really good points there. Let me come at this a slightly, let me switch over to a completely different topic, but one that I just find interesting. Of course, you know Rupert Spira?
Yes.
Right. So very interesting, fantastic non-dual teacher as well. Hope to have him on this show in not too long. He said something that really struck me. He says, you know, enlightenment is not exotic. India is exotic. And I thought that's such a beautiful statement because he's saying enlightenment is really this natural part of unfolding that we can get to from a lot of different ways. And I wonder if we could say the same thing, again, as a longtime practitioner of yoga and yoga student, not anywhere near to the level that you are, but I think we could substitute yoga in that. You know, yoga isn't exotic. India is exotic. To what extent have we made these ideas, these practices, more exotic than they need to be? And is that a problem that we need to address?
You bring up an excellent point. The word enlightenment, I think the word spiritual, I think the word yoga, they all summon up a lot of mystical kind of myths that need to be broken. Yoga, for me, is simply a series of experiments, we might say, we enter into to investigate how we see things and to, in a way, inquire into our conditioning that makes us see with often blinders or in a very limited way. You know, if we take the word enlightenment, enlightenment. We're just learning to shed light on how our conditioning has boxed us in, and we're learning to see things that otherwise we're not aware of because of our conditioned way we see things. So yoga, we might say meditation, is simply a series of ways we inquire into our conditioning, the way we've been conditioned to see reality in a certain way, and it helps break our conditioning so we see things afresh, we might say. So yeah, I agree, this aspect of India is exotic, but yoga to me is just a series of simple inquiries, meditation, simple inquiries that enlighten us. It brings new understandings that we didn't have before.
You know, the other thing I think it points to is this often heard quote, you know, every great cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and eventually degrades into a racket. And I think we've all experienced that along the spiritual path, as well as along the just self-development, self-improvement path. How do we avoid that? How do you avoid that? Do you have any concerns about that?
I'm glad. I'm a pragmatic optimist. I know in the end it will be overcome, and pragmatically, I know it takes time. You know, you say it can degenerate into a business. The beauty that I see about us as human beings is we have an inner compass. When we begin to go away from a truth, something that's really a reality, something in us starts to feel something's not right here. And we can go away, you know, far away and say we're yoga degenerates into a business and whatever, however you were saying it. But as we go more and more in that way, we're going to feel a split within ourselves. Something about that doesn't feel right. And eventually my optimist says that's going to help reorient us and bring us back to the path that we may have gone away from. So I've been doing yoga for the last 46 years, meditating for the last 46 years. At first, yoga helped open me to great insights, and then I would say I began to stray more into the more materialist aspects of it. And the more I did that, something within me just didn't feel right, and I kept following, what is it about what's happening that doesn't feel right? And it kept bringing me back to what I will call a deeper truth and a deeper understanding. So, yeah, everything degenerates eventually, but optimistically, I hold that eventually we'll always come back, because we can only stray away from the ground of truth so far. We see this in the world today, all these acts of racism, violence, hatred, reactionary movements. That's, for me, people who are separating and going farther and farther away from themselves. We can only go so far, and then we'll start that return journey. And those of us who are holding that deeper understanding, because we went away and came back, we now are able to, see a deeper truth here, and hopefully help those who are going off the path come back in their own right sense of self.
That's awesome, and I have no disagreement with anything you're saying. Let me kind of hit you with one more thing that does always kind of gnaw at me a little bit in terms of the non-dual community. And that is, you know, there's a lot of people who on one hand want to agree and experience an agreement, a synergy with what you're saying. And at the same time have this sense that you're just kind of glossing over a lot of life. I mean, a lot of ordinary life experience, like love and family and loss and grief, and also some pretty significant non-ordinary life experience, near-death experience, where people have these tremendous out-of-body experiences, and they have after-death communication, whether it's part of a near-death experience or not, or they do some sort of out-of-body astral challenge or abduction experience, which I think you have to take seriously if you really study it. Psychedelics, the list goes on and on and on. And I don't think you're saying that we have to ignore that or minimize that, but do you understand, I think, the feeling that some people get that the simplicity of the non-dual, sit down, you know, there's a nothingness there, return to the seat of consciousness, and everything falls back into that consciousness, glosses over, in a way, a lot of what people are finding most relevant, the stuff that's stirring up the most for them in their life. Do you have a sense for what I'm talking about, and can you address that?
Yeah, I think there are basic movements here. One is, we find ourselves in a moment in our life where our life isn't working. Something has failed us. We're feeling a sense sometimes of a helplessness, a hopelessness, some inner collapse. It might come as an anxiety, a depression, whatever. And we try all sorts of ways to go through it. And ultimately, we may take up meditation, the practices of yoga, the practices that we're talking about here. And there's a moment where we open to this other realm, which we might say is timeless and spacious and open. And we sit in that realm for a while, but then what happens is it brings us back into life itself, where we re-enter into these movements as you're talking about, which is relationship. How do we move this in every domain of our life? We come back. And I think what happens is we start to really become a fully functional human being, where we're friends with our emotions, we're friends with our thoughts, we understand these movements of sadness, grief. We're not trying to negate them, we're not trying to transcend them, we're actually grounding more deeply into our basic humanness.
We're not trying to transcend them. Can you pick up on that a little bit? I think that's key, because especially if I've had a rather dramatic, let's say I've had a spiritually transformative experience that it's impossible for me to get past. I saw Jesus. I put my hands where his wounds are. You know, that also can become somewhat of a block, even though it propelled me from 0 to 50. It also then becomes, I can't get past that.
You know, when we have an experience like that, it takes time to integrate it. But what it's really asking us, and if you look at the teachings of Jesus, he's asking you to come back into the world, love your neighbor as yourself, bring love back into our relationships. He's also not saying don't dismiss the violence that is around us and confront it, but confront it not from that's the enemy over there, but that is an aspect of ourself that's kind of gone into separation and gone away from themselves. So we're trying to actually move into the world in a deeper grounded sense of love and right action, right speech, right thought. So what I see is, as I've walked this path, yeah, there have been moments of deep transcendence where I've had to sit in those experiences, hanging out with Jesus, hanging out in a world that you call formless or empty. But then the real movement of meditation is to come back into the world, reground back into all the different emotions and feelings that I have as a human being, and how now do I take that into my relationships, where my relationships now deepen and are much more, much more authentic and real than they may have been before when I was just caught in certain conditioned beliefs. So if meditation is really working, we're becoming deeper, more profound, more loving and kind human beings, not trapped in mystical experiences.
What do you mean trapped in mystical experiences?
Well, my joke is in the 60s, many of us tried to check into what I call the Om Hotel. We tried to transcend our basic humanness and emotions of anger and sadness and grief. And what we found was in the 80s and 90s, we had to come back into the world. We had to ground back into living in the world, ground back into our jobs. We had to make a living. We've got to bring food to the table. And
why? To what extent? I mean, most of us seem way over engaged in all that.
Way over engaged in
that, making money and getting on our iPhone and making sure that our emails are up to date and all the rest of that stuff.
I think, yeah, of course. But now we're talking about balance and harmony. If we do too much of the materialistic striving for money, striving for fame, we will start to feel something in ourselves that isn't working. The practices of meditation help us look at what isn't working, rebalance it. And then, yeah, we have to come back. We still have to put food on the table. We still have to have clothes on our back. But now it's more from a sense of harmony, in the sense that we're making enough money that helps us move forward in life, but we're doing it in a way that also we're looking at the people around us as our brothers and sisters. How do I help them when they're struggling? So it's no longer just about me, it's about us. And I think that materialistic view and striving for fame and fortune and money is all about me. When that me is really seen through, it becomes about us. We are a integrated community here, of like-minded people around the world, which we're trying to help, not just be out for myself only.
Richard, tell folks a little bit more about what you do, how people might run into you on the trail, maybe find some of this training. Can they find it at IRESH? Can they find it in some of your seminars through some of the other teachers that you've taught? How do people go about it? If they're going to listen to this, and if it, you know, has that moment of boom, a resonation with them, then they want to know more. How do they go about it?
I think the first part is to go to the website www.irest.us, and they'll find workshops, retreats, trainings that I and my teachers are doing around the world. We also have literature, CDs. I've recently written a book called The IRES Program for Healing Post-Traumatic Stress. I've got CDs on how to get a restful night's sleep, because many of the veterans that we're working with, all the way back to Vietnam, Korean, and even a few World War II, they said as they do the IRES program, they've gotten the first good night's sleep since, say, Vietnam. So they can go to the website, irest.us, where they'll find plenty of portals into all of our offerings, both here in the United States and around the world.
Great. Our guest again has been Dr. Richard Miller. It's been fantastic having you on. Thanks again so much, Richard.
Thank you, Alex.
Okay, man. That's it. You're great. You're great.
You know, I was so, I woke up this morning after all of this Orlando fiasco, and I wrote a little piece on Facebook just about, you know, we've got to get over this racism and hatred and vitriolic diatribes that are going, and just come back to seeing each other as brothers and sisters. My God, how far do we have to go away from one another before we finally realize we need to come back?
Jeez, boy, I don't know. See, that's the part, and that we just kind of touched on. I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, you know, people rail against. I don't know what's going to happen to Orlando, how it turns out to be. But if the script is like all the other scripts, it's going to turn out to be going to have links to government-run operations that are trying to undermine the Second Amendment. And I have to say that I've never owned a gun in my life. I've only shot a gun one time when I was in Alaska. It's kind of a prank. But there are other forces at play. You know, not to get political, but ISIS is a Al-Qaeda operation that is funded by the United States. I mean, we are the excess of evil in the world, you know, and we do a lot of wonderful things too. And who knows what would fill that if we weren't there, whether it be Russia or China, it'd be a lot worse. But I don't know. I mean, I think we're pushed into accepting these kind of simplistic ideas about how the world works. And I think that's a deeper part of what the non-dual community really has to do is say, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know. I don't know how these forces interact. And I just know my personal transformation is this. My personal approach for being more loving, for being more connecting, for healing myself and the people around me is this. I'm real uncomfortable when we start talking about Orlando because I don't know what the fuck happened in Orlando, and
well,
I don't know if it's a CIA operation.
The thing I'm aware of is like Orlando pushes me back to what's my garden that I've been given to tend. Am I really tending it? And
everybody has,
I'm convinced, their own garden. If they would only tend it, all these aspects wouldn't be happening. So all that does for me is it gets me more engaged in tending the garden I've been given. So working with the homeless, working with the women who've been trafficked, working with the soldiers, and working with my neighbors and my family. So yeah, I think it forces me back into, am I doing all that I can with the tools that I've been given by life? I wish everybody would just tend their own garden and we wouldn't be seeing all this crap going on.
I agree with you. Okay, well, thanks again so much, Richard. I really appreciate everything that you're doing, and I will definitely send you a link
Great.
When I get this thing up in about
Great.
A month. Thanks again to Richard Miller for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview before I get to Richard's guided meditation, which is going to immediately follow this outro, so do stick around for that. Why does Richard Miller's meditation protocol work? Why specifically do you think this protocol is so effective? I have some definite, strong ideas that are my answer to that question, but I'd love to hear what you think. The place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptico website. From there, you can bounce on over to the forum and join a conversation, leave a Facebook message or a Facebook comment, or just drop me an email. The important thing is that you connect with me, connect with the show, connect with people who are interested in these ideas. Because let's face it, it's sometimes hard to walk this path in the busy materialistic world we live in. So joining together, sharing these ideas, bolstering each other might make it just a little bit easier. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. I have some good ones coming up. Please stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care, and now do stick around for Richard Miller's Questions as Being.
Take a moment. You're not yet ready to go on to the next thing of doing, and you're just sitting here in a delightful sense of being. that even may be the felt sense of being awareness. Five questions. Answer it from being. So as being, how would you describe your location? Your outermost border or boundary, your innermost center. Just feel into that for a few moments. How would I describe myself as being? And the second inquiry, as being, when you're just being, what's happening to thinking? When you're just feeling being. So we might ask, when you're just being, what time is it? What's your relationship to time? Back to being and ask yourself, as being, do I need anything that by acquiring it would make me as being any better than I already am? I, as being, lack or want for anything? Unfamiliar, or is this something that you've known all your life? Fifth thing. inquiry as being, is there anything special I need to do?